I was going to speak on a theology of sleep this afternoon. I honestly was not sleeping. I would have liked to have reversed a couple of things here. Tomorrow afternoon I hope to preach on a theology of the body. A healthy body, healthy ministry. I think it's a very important topic for pastors, for church planters maybe especially. I would have liked to have done that one first. It sort of lays general principles from the Bible about how we are to view our bodies, and then done this address as a follow-up, as a practical application in one particular area. But I decided not to. I decided to start with this one. And you'll get the principles tomorrow. So, I want to talk about theology of sleep because from my own personal experience in the ministry and from many counselling sessions with pastors, church planters, I believe that this is an area of great concern and is causing a lot of harm and damage in ministers' lives, pastors' lives. When I have pastors come to me who have burned out physically or crashed spiritually or fallen morally, and we start tracing back the steps that led up to this, almost in every single case, it all began with a neglect of the body. It didn't begin with, you know, surfing on the internet or visiting single women late hours on their own or neglecting to simply read and pray. That's not where these problems began. In the vast majority of cases, they began with a neglect of the body. And as a result, I've often spoken to pastors about the repair bays in the garage that they have to visit. And I usually speak of five repair bays. And like our own cars, we don't just go to the garage when we break down. These are five repair bays that we want to go to regularly for servicing, even when things are going well. And the first repair bay I usually speak about is routine. Routine. The first question I ask pastors when I talk with them, and by the way, if you don't want to counsel a lot of pastors, don't write a book called Christians Get Depressed Too. But the first question I usually ask the people is, tell me your routine. And I usually get puzzled looks. And they said, routine? I don't have any routine. Well, I said, tell me a normal day. There is no normal day. And we begin to talk about how God is a God of order, not a God of confusion. And we thrive when we image him. As his image bearers, we will thrive when we have orderly lives. Our bodies have been designed by God with a certain rhythm, with a regularity, with an order that if we match with our lifestyle, we will thrive and flourish. And if we try and fight against it, we will sink for sure. And so we usually want to look at areas like sleeping, eating, working hours, and so on. So I would love to spend a session on that, but I'm just going to go through four of these bays very quickly. Routine is one of them. The second one is rethinking. In my little book, Christians Get Depressed Too, I show 10 false thinking patterns that we often fall into and how to get out of these by identifying false thinking patterns, challenging them, and changing them, using the pattern of Psalm 42, Psalm 77. Third area is recreation. Exercise, basically, which expels harmful chemicals in our bodies and stimulates the production of good ones. Spurgeon said, the next best thing to the grace of God for a preacher is oxygen. William Blakey said, it's very certain that due attention to physical exercise is an essential condition of sustained, vigorous preaching. The command to be strong in the Lord includes strength of body as well as strength of soul. Fourth area is relaxation. Two areas here. The first is simply breathing. Believe it or not, a lot of us should really relearn how to breathe. When this was first pointed out to me, I realised that I had got into some very bad habits of breathing that were fast and shallow. I'd probably not filled my lungs for years and years. And I mean, you can go on YouTube and find lots of videos for breathing techniques. You find a lot of nonsense too. You know, just ignore all the yoga stuff and that. But there's just some real basics about the way we breathe that brings oxygen into our bodies and gets it to all our peripheries and especially to our minds. And the other area is simply bodily relaxation. Again, some very simple techniques for relaxing the body from top to toe. Again, the first time this was pointed out to me, I thought it was a bit kind of goofy and spooky until I realised how tense I was. I thought I was quite a laid back kind of guy, but I wasn't, and probably still am, but you know, we even have muscles here, which kind of surprised me, but you know, when it was pointed out again, I realised the tension that was there. If you think about it, you know, if you were to, you know, tense up your muscle, if you've got one, you know, as hard as you can for, you know, even a couple of minutes, and then you let go, there's an ache there. And a lot of us, our whole bodies are like that. Maybe not 100% tense, but over tense, which is causing a lot of physical and mental and spiritual problems. We need to learn how to relax. And the fifth R, the fifth repair bay, is rest. Again, we could split this into two. And we talk about Sabbath rest, one day in seven. You know how that commandment says, 6 days you shall labour, except you're a pastor, when you have to work 7 days a week? Oh, it doesn't say that? Well, pastors think it does. 6 days you shall labour and do all your work. But the seventh day, that's just a principle, isn't it, of that God has built into us again, which we neglect at our peril. But the second area of rest, and it's the one I want to focus on, is sleep. There is an epidemic of sleeplessness in our society. The National Institutes of Health says that school-aged children need about 10 hours daily. Teens need 9 to 10, adults 7 to 8. But between a third and half of all Americans are not getting the recommended sleep. 40 million Americans suffer from over 70 sleep disorders. 60% of adults report having sleep problems a few nights a week or more. 40% report unintentionally falling asleep during the day at least once in the preceding month. 5% report nodding off at the wheel while driving at least once in the preceding month. This is a moral issue. This is not just, hey, that would be nice. No, this is a moral issue. And I believe it's related to the commandment, you shall not kill, which requires us to take all lawful means to preserve and maintain our own lives and the lives of others. That's what I want to try and show you here. I want to first of all, show you the consequences of sleep deprivation and how it is a moral issue. Let's look first of all at physical consequences. Just 1 week of sleeping fewer than 6 hours a night results in changes to more than 700 genes in our body. just one night of sleep deprivation is linked with signs of brain tissue loss. Sleeping fewer than 7 hours a night is associated with a tripled risk of coming down with a cold. Sleep deprivation increases hunger, portion size, preference for high calorie, high carb foods, with the resulting risk of obesity. Chronic sleep deprivation, which is less than 6 hours a night for a month or more, is associated with a 4 times greater risk of stroke for middle-aged and older people, 50% greater risk of colorectal cancers, 50% higher chance of dying from heart disease, and lower fertility rates. A lot of physical consequences when we are not sleeping well or properly. Think secondly of the consequences for sport. Elite athletes are increasingly realizing how vital a component sleep is to their training, and many of them now, in addition to their physical coach, their psychological coach, their nutritional coach, now have a sleep coach, believe it or not. And it's because they realise how vital this is for performing at a high level. Sleep loss means an 11% reduction in the time it takes to become exhausted in sport. In other words, if it took you 10 minutes to get exhausted running, it only is going to take you 9 minutes. Maximum bench press drops 20 pounds after 4 days of restricted sleep. Rested tennis players get a 42% boost in hitting accuracy during drills. You say, what's this got to do with me? I don't exactly play tennis in ministry, but it's all to illustrate the impact. We still need physical, mental sharpness. Sleep extension gave swimmers a 17% improvement in reaction time of the starting blocks. Now here are some staggering figures. When you hear how many hours a night these elite athletes sleep, Roger Federer, 11 hours a night. Usain Bolt, 8 to 10 hours sleep a night. You kind of think these guys, they're supermen. They don't sleep. Not true. LeBron James, 12 hours a night and as many naps as he can through the day. I don't think he's a lazy man, is he? 12 hours a night. Michelle Wee, 10 to 12 hours a night, female golfer. Rafael Nadal, 8 to 9 hours a night. Tiger Woods, 4 to 5 hours a night. Does that explain something, maybe? Grant Hill, what's he do? Okay, race cars. Said, I think sleep is just as important as diet and exercise. Jared Shoemaker, anyone know what he does? A jockey? Your guess is as good as mine. Sleep is half my training. Roger Federer, if I don't sleep 11 to 12 hours a night, it doesn't feel right. Kerry Walsh, I think she's one of these volleyball players, beach volleyball, I'm told. No seen. A well-rested body is healthier, more efficient, more capable. She said, this is the hardest thing to accomplish on my to-do list. But it always makes a difference. Usain Bolt, sleep is extremely important to me. I need to rest and recover in order for the training I do to be absorbed by my body. Let's think thirdly, though, of the intellectual consequences. Coming closer to home, this is the tool we need, isn't it, most? Sleep flushes dangerous proteins from our brains. Somebody said, when you're sleep deprived, you get a dirty brain. Sleep's been sort of described as the dishwasher of the brain. Sleep allows the day's memories to be consolidated and made more recoverable. Chronic sleep deprivation in adolescence diminishes the brain's ability to learn new information. There are emotional consequences, fourthly. Sleep deprivation produces irritability, apathy, weepiness, anger. It can cause a psychological damage. It regulates the flow of dopamine and serotonin, chemicals closely associated with mood and behavior. People with insomnia are 10 times as likely to develop depression, 17 times as likely to have significant anxiety. The lack of sleep affects the teenage brain in similar ways to the adult brain, only worse. In one study by researchers at Columbia University, teens who went to bed at 10 p.m. or earlier were less likely to suffer from depression and suicidal thoughts than those who stayed awake regularly after midnight. But then think of the societal consequences of this. This is where we're getting to love of neighbour as well as loving oneself. Sleep is increasingly recognised as important to public health, with sleep insufficiency linked to motor vehicle crashes, industrial disasters, medical and other occupational errors. Here are some well-known disasters that have been related to or linked to sleep deprivation in some operators. Exxon Valdez, Challenger Space Shuttle, the Metro North train in New York more recently, all of them linked to sleep deprivation. The cognitive impairment that results from being awake for 24 hours is higher than the drink drive limit in all states. Young people in their teens and 20s are involved in more than half of all the fall asleep crashes in the nation's highways each year. There are also financial consequences. It's reckoned to cost the American economy $63 billion a year through undermining of creativity, problem-solving ability, and productivity. And the worst costs arise from safety lapses, which we've already mentioned. Americans spend $32 billion a year on meds, mattresses, candles, and consultants to try and help them to sleep. There are also educational consequences. 60% of grade school and high school children report that they're tired through the daytime. 15% admit to falling asleep in class. The United States has the highest number of sleep-deprived students in the world, with 70 to 80% of 9 to 14-year-olds identified as being adversely affected by a lack of sleep. And here's something even more significant. Moral consequences. It's a moral issue, but there are also very specific moral consequences. A lack of sleep has been shown to rob the fuel for self-control in the region of the brain responsible for self-control. In other words, we've all got a limit of fuel that's, as it were, in our brain every day. Sleep deprivation reduces it, meaning that that area that's related to our ability to control our responses is reduced. Studies found a lack of sleep led to high levels of unethical behaviour. They did a study of people who had certain amounts of sleep and then gave them an opportunity to cheat in a certain situation. And they divided the people who chose to cheat from those who decided not to cheat. And here's the significant thing. Those who decided not to cheat had, on average, 22 minutes more sleep per day than those who decided to cheat. That was the only significant difference in their lifestyles. The difference between cheating and not cheating was 22 minutes more in bed. I think we all recognize this. You know, when we're tired, it is much easier to sin. We do lack the willpower and the desire and the determination to refuse temptation. Interestingly, there's a New York Times bestseller out just now called Thrive by Arianna Huffington of Huffington Post fame or infamy, whatever you want to call it. And she wrote this book because she was living 110 miles per hour. she reckoned sleeping 4 to 5 hours a day, working 18 to 19 hours a day, and doing that for a number of years as she tried to establish her media empire. One day, she was sitting at her desk, she fell asleep at her desk, and as she collapsed to the floor, she smashed her face off the edge of the desk or table, smashing her cheekbone, and ended up in hospital for a number of days, and many months of medical treatment followed. And it was like a wake-up call, literally, to her. They said, you just can't keep living at this. And now she calls herself a sleep evangelist. And together with Sheryl Sandberg, the COO of Facebook, they had a conference in, I think, San Francisco a couple of weeks ago. It was called Sleep Your Way to the Top. And their point was, they both come to realize that, you know, the success you buy through lack of sleep is just not worth it. And in fact, in the longer term, sleeping does produce more success. And at that conference, I think it was Huffington quoted Bill Clinton, who had said to her that all his major moral mistakes occurred at times in his life when he was depriving himself of sleep. And again, the ministers that I've counseled, pastors who have fallen, again, this has been a common theme that I've come across. This has moral consequences. I suppose it's part of our own responsibility when we're praying, lead us not into temptation. We can actually help that by sleeping. And that leads to spiritual consequences. Don Carson said this: doubt may be fostered by sleep deprivation. If you keep burning the candle at both ends, sooner or later you will indulge in more and more cynicism. And the line between cynicism and doubt is a very thin one. If you're among those who become nasty, cynical, or even full of doubt when you're missing your sleep, hand up here. You're morally obligated to try and get the sleep you need. We are whole, complicated beings. Our physical existence is tied to our spiritual well-being, to our mental outlook, to our relationship with others, including our relationship with God. Sometimes, he says, the godliest thing you can do in the universe is get a good night's sleep. Not pray all night, but sleep all night. So, I hope I've, in that scan of a lot of research, shown you that there are significant and serious consequences to sleep deprivation in many different areas of life. But let me just briefly talk here about the causes of sleep deprivation, the causes of sleep deprivation. In some cases, it's ignorance. We just don't know. Or we didn't know until today. The impact of sleeplessness upon us and those around us. We don't realise maybe what's causing our sleeplessness. We are in ignorance. For example, using computer screens late at night has been shown to cause sleeplessness. I remember a pastor saying to me about how he just couldn't sleep, and he's tried watching all the TV channels he could to try and put himself to sleep. And like, it's glaring in the face. You're basically, you know, looking at the brightest light in the room and then expecting to fall asleep afterwards. You know, what's the last thing a lot of us do when we go to bed at night? We turn this on, we check our email or Facebook or whatever. And it's been shown that the luminosity of these screens when close to the eyes is pretty close to the sun on a cloudy day. And so we're basically looking at the sun behind a cloud, and the brain's getting this message, hey, up and at them. You know, it's daytime, let's go. And then we're expecting to fall asleep a few seconds later when the brain's been stimulated and it's received the messages, time to work. That's not going to happen. So it can be ignorance, it can be often greed or ambition. If I'm thinking, well, I'm supposed to spend 20 years of my life asleep. If I can cut down on that, maybe gain 5 years, I'll earn more money. I'll be more competitive. I'll be more productive. I'll be more successful. But what's motivating it is greed. Now, of course, we would hope that ministers of gospel are not motivated by greed, but ambition, for sure, at times, pride, desire for reputation, success, results, can also drive sleeplessness. Workaholism, that's certainly in the ministry, and perhaps ministers more liable to it than others. We view it as a calling, we love it, we enjoy it, we don't do anything else in the world, and it becomes almost like an idol then. We find maybe our identity in our work, again, causing us to cut back on things like sleep. It can be simple indiscipline. We know, and yet we won't do. We know what's necessary, we know we've got bad habits, but we won't change them. We won't become more disciplined. Stress, again, in the ministry, very common, and a great cause of sleeplessness. So I think it's helpful to have a look, right, okay, why am I not sleeping so well? What are the causes? Are there sin issues here, idolatry issues, stress issues? And try and trace back the sleeplessness to a cause so that we can then deal with it. And that brings me to my last point, the cure for sleep deprivation. It's probably not a good time to be giving this address, is it? Like 2:30 on a Saturday afternoon at the end of a conference when everyone's wanting to go to the beach. But there are two cures, better practices and better theology. Better practices, you don't need me for that. You can go onto the internet and get dozens, hundreds, thousands of articles about how to get better sleep habits. Things like routine, same routine before bed every night, winding down earlier rather than later, don't exercise too late, don't eat food too late, don't drink alcohol too late, maybe don't drink it at all, minimise noise, heat, light, you know, lots of just basic common sense things, but sometimes we're not so commonsensical. So better practices, again, go find yourself. I'd like to give you some better theology to finish up with. I think when we begin to realise how much there is a theology of sleep in the Bible, it begins to hopefully change our view of it, not as a necessary evil, but as we'll see, a gift of God. Number one, God created us with a need for sleep. Part of the creator-creature distinction. Sleep reminds us that God is God and we are not. That God's the creator and we are simply creatures. He's sovereign, we are not. And he created us with sleep to remind us of that distinction. To remind us that he's creator, that he is sovereign, that he is God. He created us to need sleep as much as we need oxygen, as much as we need food. And without it, therefore, we will uncreate ourselves. If he's created us to have this need, if we don't meet the need, we are going to start disintegrating in one of these many ways that we've looked at. Number two, God gifts us with sleep. We're told of that in Psalm 3 and Psalm 4. Told that in Psalm 127 verse 2. He gives his beloved sleep. It's a gift of love. Again, might change the way we view it. John Bailey, in his essay entitled The Theology of Sleep, says, he gives to his beloved sleep might also be translated, he gives to his beloved in sleep. In other words, this is speaking not only of the blessing of sleep itself, but of all the blessings that come to us through sleep. It's a gift to be received with gratitude. Number three, God uses sleep to remind us we are not necessary. He doesn't need us. Even President Obama has to sleep. He's got to get into his pajamas every night. get under the covers, head in the pillow, and say bye-bye to the world. It's a reminder to him that he's relatively powerless and that God does not need him. God can run the world without him. That God is the superpower. By sleeping, we are relinquishing control. Sleep is by its very nature an act of humility if we are doing it in the right spirit. It's saying, okay, God doesn't need me for 7-8 hours. This church is going to actually survive. My family is going to survive. I'm going to survive. Even if I say goodbye to the world for a number of hours. So God uses this to remind us we are unnecessary. Number four, God calls us to trust him in sleep. If you look at the references to sleep in Psalm 3 and Psalm 4. By the way, do you know any modern contemporary hymns that celebrate sleep? Nope. Well, the Psalms do. But it reminds us that sleep is a test of trust. Sleep is a test of trust. Will we entrust ourselves and all that we have and everything to God's care? In that sense, the Christian's sleep should be different to the non-Christian's. The spirit in which we sleep, the attitude with which we sleep, how long we sleep makes a huge statement about who we are. Somebody said unconsciousness is a pretty big sign of dependence. Don't think about that too much when you go to bed tonight. You won't sleep. Number five, God will chastise us if we rebel against this. We've seen the huge consequences of sleep deprivation. If it's an act of rebellion or disobedience, then God will chastise us for it. We might manage it for a short time, for a special purpose, but not in the long run. You think of Psalm 127, verse 2, it's vain for you to rise early and go to bed late at night. He's saying, I know you think it's really productive and helpful and necessary for you to do this, but the Bible puts a big V-A-I-N over what you're trying to do. And the word literally means wind, empty, vain, hebel. There's nothing to it. It's utterly pointless. 'Tis vain for you. And God will remind us of this if we think, no, there's a point and a purpose. John Piper gave a lecture on Charles Spurgeon in 1995, and this is what he said. A personal word to you younger men. I'm finishing my 15th year at Bethlehem, and I've just celebrated my 49th birthday. I've watched my body and my soul with some care over these years and noticed some changes. They're partly owing to changing circumstances, but much is owing to a changing constitution. One, I cannot eat as much without gaining unhelpful weight. My body doesn't metabolize the same way it used to. Another is, I'm emotionally less resilient when I lose sleep. There were early days when I would work without regard to sleep and feel energized and motivated. But in the last 7 or 8 years, my threshold for despondency is much lower. For me, says Piper, adequate sleep is not a matter of staying healthy. It's a matter of staying in the ministry. It's irrational that my future should look bleaker when I get 4 or 5 hours sleep several nights in a row. But that's irrelevant. Those are the facts. And I must live within the limits of facts. I commend sufficient sleep to you, says Piper, for the sake of your proper assessment of God and of his promises. Isn't that an interesting thought? He's saying, without proper sleep, your view of God will change. Your view of God's promises will change. Number six, God reminds us of death using sleep. It's often described, isn't it, as a falling asleep, at least for the believer. Sleep is a good practice for dying. The time when we will close our eyes for the last time and never see the earth again. It's a useful reminder. We have a really big help there for every day to remember our mortality. When every night we have to go to bed and close our eyes in an act that we will do for a last time, one time, a time probably not too distant from any of us. And it's good to be reminded of our mortality. Number 7, God uses sleep to remind us of hell. At least that's what my nightmares do. I often used to wonder, well, why do I have such horrific dreams? I believe the purpose is to remind me of hell. It's to remind me of the torment, the horror, the terror of hell, the irrationality of hell, the disorder, the chaos. Apparently, nightmares that seem to us to go on for hours and hours and hours only last, apparently, for but a few seconds. It's like there's a film going on in our brain that is running at 100 times faster than a normal film would run. And it all just pours into our brain in just a very few seconds. And then you think of that for eternity. You think of that forever. And not just that mental torment, but you add on the physical as well. And in that sense, God can even use these horrors of the night to bless us, to remind us this is what people are going to. This is what my children are going to unless they're converted. My neighbours. And in that way we can turn the worst aspects of sleep into a blessing. If it does serve to heighten our horror of hell and increase our evangelism and our passion for the lost. Number 8, God uses sleep to teach us about the Saviour. I don't know about you, but for me, Jesus slept is as profound as Jesus wept. Jesus slept. God slept. He who slumbers not nor sleeps came and took a body that needed to sleep. It reminds us of our Saviour's humanity. Every time I go to bed at night, I can think of Jesus doing this every night for 33 years. He had to sleep. And what's maybe even more amazing is he did it perfectly. Not too much, not too little. It's astounding, isn't it? It brings me to worship. Because of his humanity, his frail, his weak, his needy humanity that he was willing to take for me, but also just his perfect humanity. Number 9, God teaches us about salvation. Does sleep not remind us of how much we contribute to salvation? How much? Nothing. Come unto me, all you who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Salvation is pictured as resting. Go and watch your child or your husband or your wife sleeping tonight. And watch how much they move. Well, okay. In some cases, there's a lot of movement. Look at your baby or your youngest child. The depth of that sleep, the trust of that sleep. They're not even moving a pinky. And that's what Jesus says our salvation is. Don't even move a pinky. Don't contribute a thing. Just come to me and rest. Be in deep, pleasant, peaceful rest in me. He says, I'll give you that. I'll give you such a sense of rest that it's as deep as the deepest sleep, as refreshing, as renewing, as reviving, as energizing. Every time we enter into that. What is objectively true, we enter into it subjectively. There's renewal and refreshing. Lastly, God teaches us about conversion. Awake, you who sleep, and rise from the dead, and Christ will give you life. It's interesting, he uses sleep, rest, to illustrate salvation, but also awaking out of sleep. It's obviously looking at two aspects of salvation. Waking up out of sleep each morning should remind us, in other words, of the time God awoke us from our deepest sleep, the sleep of death, and brought us into the light, into the daytime, into life itself. So I hope you can see from so many angles the way God uses sleep to teach us about so many things, that this is of momentous significance. Yes, we need better practices to help us sleep better, but we need also better theology. And together these two forces, for good, I hope, will produce sleep. I mean, what other commandment can you keep in your bed, fast asleep, so perfectly, as the sixth commandment, you shall not kill?